You are listening to Screenfish Radio. I'm your host, Steve Norton. This week on the show, myself, Julie, and Paul Levesque take on Widows, Steve McQueen's latest thriller starring Viola Davis, Elizabeth Debicki, Liam Neeson, Colin Farrell, Robert Duvall, and half of Hollywood. As we dive into this exciting thriller, we get to talk about powerful women on screen and covering the truth with lies. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Welcome to Screenfish Radio. We're so glad you could join us this week as we talk about Steve McQueen's Widows. This week we have back our team of Levesques. Paul and Julie, welcome, guys. It's so glad to have you guys on.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, thanks. Good to be here.
It's great to have you guys back. And this week we are talking about Widows, Steve McQueen's thriller starring Viola Davis, Elizabeth Debicki, Daniel Kaluuya, Michelle Rodriguez, Liam Neeson, and half of Hollywood. It's true. It's a huge cast. When a police shootout leaves four thieves dead during an explosive armed robbery attempt in Chicago, their widows have nothing in common except a debt left behind by their spouses' criminal activities. Hoping to forge a future on their own terms, Veronica joins forces with the other three women to pull off a heist that her husband was planning. Just a reminder as we begin the podcast that it is rated S for spoilers, so you should know that in advance. Paul, Julie, what did you think of Widows?
I liked Widows. I was initially very attracted to the cast. I mean, if you weren't attracted to this cast, what is wrong with you? Viola Davis, Liam Neeson, Michelle Rodriguez. I'm going to keep going. Colin Farrell, you know, Brian Tyree Henry, who is in everything right now. He was in three different movies at TIFF this year. And then Daniel Kaluuya. I mean, coming off of the Get Out phenomenon, how can you not see a movie with Daniel Kaluuya in it? You know what I mean? It was a very interesting role for him, though. Totally different. He was terrifying. this movie, there was a lot of moving parts to this movie, and it's one of those ones that you have to pay attention to. And I saw it twice, and I'm still finding myself questioning, like, hang on, what did that person do? And then there was that scene and this and that. So there were definitely moments where it dragged. It was a very good movie. I was very attracted to the female empowerment aspect. And I almost feel like I have to see it a third time to fully grasp it.
I enjoyed it. I felt like this was the female equivalent to Heat to a certain extent.
Interesting.
Different cast, obviously, different context, not bank robbery, but, you know, it's still a heist movie in its core, but with a lot of added elements and a phenomenal cast, to be quite honest. I'm a huge Brian Tyree Henry fan ever since I saw him in Atlanta. For the record, Julie, Alderman is like city councilor, officially.
Okay, because I'm like, why is this such a huge deal? And it's resulting in murder, and, like, they're not trying to be, you know, senators. It's just city council.
Pretty much exactly city council.
It's just city council, guys. Don't get excited about it.
But it's Chicago. It's, you know, it's cutthroat.
Yeah, it's Chicago.
You should know that from the musical, right?
Wow.
Yeah, I felt this was very similar to the musical Chicago. Oh my gosh, now I'm going to be thinking about that.
There was a dude named Lipschitz in this, wasn't it?
Yeah. Now I really want to listen to the soundtrack.
You know what? I absolutely loved this movie. I've seen it now twice as well. The first time I liked it, the second time I really got a deeper appreciation for it. I love a thriller that's filmed well. And this one is shot beautifully.
Yes.
Daniel Kaluuya, every time he's on screen, the camera stalks him in a way that it doesn't do that to any of the other characters. It is just uncanny. So many long takes. It circles him. It just follows him. It's almost like he's some sort of viper. And I really noticed it, especially the second time. You know, there's the scene, of course, in the gym where he knocks off the two guys, where it's just one long take and it's just circling him and circling him. But it does it also later on when they go after the driver. What's the driver's name? Bash. And they just, you know, the guys go and kick the snot out of him and he sits down and the camera just follows him. He's going to watch cartoons right now. So let's watch him watching cartoons. We don't need to see the violence. Let's just, it's just beautifully shot. And there's actually
to a certain extent in the bowling alley scene too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. There is one long take that I recall that has nothing to do with him. And it's really interesting. Did you notice the one when Colin Farrell gets into his car?
Yes, I actually wrote that down. That was very interesting. Because he's having a full-on conversation with his assistant in the car, but you don't see them at all. The camera is on the hood of the car facing, and I won't say it's facing outward. Half of it is the car and half of it is out onto the street. So then you see a rich neighborhood, a gorgeous neighborhood. And then as the conversation is happening, the camera slowly pans to the other side of the street. And what do we see? But the projects, or yeah. Sorry, let me begin by saying it was the projects first.
Yes.
They were getting away from the MWOW conference.
Yes.
And then they pan over to the rich neighborhood and it's just maybe a couple minute drive. And that's where Mulligan lives, just right down the street from where these projects are.
You see, that was something I appreciated about this film so well, is they could have gone for, you know, the erratic, crazy camera movements that we see nowadays that try to fake excitement. You know, when you, what was that? There was a movie years ago with Shia LaBeouf, the Disturbia, and that movie is just one crazy short take after another, and it's a thriller, and that's just how the new thriller's got to be, right? Like, keep it moving, keep it moving. This one lets you feel it slowly.
Yeah.
That's why it's so well. The cast is excellent. The story is solid, and it's just beautiful to see, and it's not making any money. I don't understand. This is why we can't have nice things.
That's too funny. Stop it. No, I agree with you. I think that this film is very unique and it's got so many really cool elements to it. Like I said, it drags in spots.
Sure.
But I think that when they hit it, you were mentioning they kind of let you feel it and they don't push it. When they can nail that on the head, it works really, really well. I'm wondering if maybe the film is just like a little bit too early. Like they're before their time with this one. Do you know what I mean? Because it has a brilliance to it, but I'm feeling like maybe people aren't appreciating it as much as they should. You know, the Golden Globes were just announced. Widows is not anywhere close to it. You know what I mean?
I don't know if it's before its time. I would almost say that this is going to play better on a platform like Netflix or streaming, in the sense that it has stopping power with the cast. But other than that, I've heard nobody talk about this except me, amongst friends groups and people at work.
Right.
I don't know anybody that's seen this at all, other than myself or the two of us talking here. And that's not indicative of a poor film. I just don't think it has I'm losing my train of thought here, but it doesn't have the word of mouth I'm trying to think of.
I don't get that, though. I'm telling you, it's got a great cast. It's got an amazing twist, and it's got a fabulous heist scene. Like, yeah. I just don't understand it.
But I think a movie like this, with a little less press than most and a little less buzz, once it hits the streaming services, people are going to say, "Oh, let me take a kick at this." one night when I don't know what else to watch, and they're going to absolutely love it.
And it's fair.
It's interesting, Julie, too, that you said it's ahead of its time, and Paul sort of said he doesn't think that's the case. How do you think it relates to this sort of cultural moment?
I think culturally it is bang on in terms of timing. I think more cinematically and the way that they drew out the story, maybe it's a little bit different than the more fast-paced world that we're living in right now, like you were mentioning. But, you know, when it comes to the female empowerment aspect of it, it's exactly what we need right now. Do you know what I mean? And that's also sort of why I think it's interesting that it's not picking up as much momentum as I thought it would, because I figured everyone will be all over a female heist movie that isn't, there's some heavy hitter male actors in this film, and they don't overshadow the females at all. Like, it was well thought out.
Yeah, you know what I appreciate about this film, and maybe this is the issue, maybe this is why it's not making any money, and this is a bit of a reach, I admit, but it's original. To me, I compare this a lot to Ocean's 8. And Ocean's 8 is fun, and I know they're totally different films. I'm not saying they're similar films, but they're both female heist films, and they both are coming out now, which is why I'm comparing them. But Ocean's 8 is part of a franchise that everybody knows. But I don't know. I really felt in Ocean's 8 that at the end of the film, it's still George Clooney's world. The movie opens and closes with her at his grave looking for him to toast her as, "You would be proud of me for doing this," sort of thing, right? Like, it's, I mean, yes, she's an Ocean, but we know of it because of Danny, because of Clooney. And it's sort of like what happened with Ghostbusters in a lot of ways. It was like, okay, we had the Ghostbusters, and you can make your whole argument about the film being flawed. But that summer I was talking with, or one of the podcast episodes we did, and somebody said that they would like to see a movie where they didn't feel like it had to be thrown into the boys' world, because that's what everyone wanted. They wanted the boy Ghostbusters, but we're going to give you girl Ghostbusters, you know, so we're stuck in this world, but we're going to give you the women in it. But with Widows, they gave you an original story that is thrilling, that is focused.
Just throwing it out there.
Quasi-original.
It's adapted from a miniseries from Britain.
Okay, that's fair. But it's not something that people are like, oh, I have to go see this miniseries on Widows.
No, fair. That takes place in London. They transplanted to Chicago. Yeah. It is a bunch of differences, enough that you could argue it's its own movie.
Right. It's fair. It's adapted in that way. But in terms of a film franchise, it's completely out, like, brand new. New world, new characters. But it's also harder to market that. So,
that's true. I really appreciated the fact that the female, because you were saying, you know, you take Ghostbusters, you take Oceans, and you just throw the females in for the sake of throwing the females in, just to, you know, to make it look good and make it equal. This one didn't feel forced at all. It didn't feel like, oh, well, they're just trying to put a group of women together to try to, you know, appeal to the masses and the current climate. It felt really good and natural. Do you know what I mean?
I think after, you know, hearing you talk about this, I'm more leaning towards Julie's end in the sense that it's a little bit ahead of its time, but not for the same reasons. I don't necessarily think that the film going public in North America specifically may be ready for a primarily female-led, female black-led cast right now. And I think
really?
That may be what's holding us back. I do. Yeah.
Interesting.
Just think about it. You just named a whole bunch of movies where they're female-led cast members that just doesn't do as well as we think they should. Granted, they're in their own IP, their borrowed intellectual property stories, if you will. The only other movie that's really broken its mold is Wonder Woman.
Mm.
But there have been other success stories of female-driven films in the last couple of years, absolutely.
Such as?
Lady Bird?
Well, that's not a blockbuster. Dramatic films, certainly. That's a fair comp. Captain Marvel hasn't come out yet.
It should hit. This is the perfect time for it to hit, but it's just not. It doesn't make sense, but yeah. It's just not clicking. And for no real reason.
Yeah. What do you guys think about the portrayal of women in this film? We talked about it being a female-led film, but what about the portrayal of women within the film? What did you think about that? What did you notice?
I noticed, and something that I appreciated very much, was that these women got stronger without their men. A lot of the time, they portray women as being weaker without the men. They got stronger. Michelle Rodriguez was being, I guess, sort of betrayed by her partner behind her back, where he was lending out money, or he owed people money. She had no idea, and she lost her business. But then, you know, we see her grow stronger and is able to gain her business back. Really, the main example of this is Alice, who was actually being physically abused by her husband. And we see her try to get herself back. She empowers herself. You even see a scene where Viola Davis slaps her in the face. And instead of kind of cowering and kind of being triggered by the fact that she used to be abused by her husband, she said no, and she slapped her right back. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So we see her growing stronger and empowering herself, even Viola Davis. I appreciated the fact that they were able to regrow and step back on their own two feet, sort of thing.
I'm with Julia to a certain extent when it comes with that. I think they started off not weak, but different versions of themselves, and for lack of a better term, leveled up or grew up as the film progressed to be versions of themselves that didn't need no man, for lack of a better term.
Oh my.
Paul got sassy.
I almost just started singing Sierra, Level Up.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to see them some grow for sure. I really felt like at the beginning of the film, in a lot of ways, their lives are sort of inconsequential. Like, you know, every character in the film necessitates the man to some extent. Even Viola Davis's character, whose name escapes me, her character arguably is the strongest of them all, but any scene we see her in a flashback, it's always with her giving goo-goo eyes to Liam Neeson. Mm-hmm. And sort of the definition of women in the beginning of this film is they seem to be, submissive isn't the word, they seem to be...
Dependent
is the word I'm looking for. Dependent on their men in some way or another. Even Michelle Rodriguez's character, who thought that she was standing up on her own two feet, soon quickly finds out that she doesn't own the store that she thought she owned in the first place. She is not on her own. And I have to say this just because her name is on my lips right now. Did either of you smile at least a little bit, or find it ironic that she needed a driver and I just wanted her to say, well, I'll call Dom.
That's
funny. I'm sorry.
I thought Michelle Rodriguez's character was very interesting because typically Michelle Rodriguez plays the same character. And I think that that's sort of by design because she doesn't accept roles of women who are not strong and powerful. But this one, even though, you know, she's part of a heist and she does become a strong and powerful woman, she does seem a little bit weaker in the beginning, which is a bit of a turn for Michelle Rodriguez. So it was interesting to see a little bit of a softer side of her. But, you know, she was still a strong woman in the end, so...
I thought it was interesting that when they start off, there are a couple of comments like, this is not your world. And it sort of pointed to the criminal aspect, but it very much comes across throughout the opening that this is man's work, to quote, apparently quote Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. It's Christmas. It's okay. Did anybody notice that there was a couple of comments, I can't believe I'm saying this, about women with balls? Did anybody notice this?
I can honestly say that's not something I picked up on.
No,
me neither.
Okay, It's even in the trailer. The key line is in the trailer, but I noticed it last night. There's a cup, or I noticed it when I saw it the second time more so. The key line is Viola Davis is talking with her crew, and she says, "The best thing we have going for us is being who we are." And then there are a couple other things she says, and they say, "Well, why?" And she says, "Because no one thinks we have the balls to pull this off."
Yes, I do remember that now.
I thought those were really interesting lines, you know, just thinking sheerly about gender, because there's this suggestion again that they can't compete in the man's world. And all the politicians are men, all the power is with men. The women are slowly becoming more powerful, but they're becoming more powerful when they become more fully who they are and move. I thought it was really interesting that that was thrown in there.
That's very powerful what you just said, I think. That's very, very interesting how they become more powerful when they become more of who they are.
Yeah, I sort of thought that the more that self-assured they became in themselves, the more they sort of stepped out of the shadows. That's how I sort of felt.
Yeah, I think that must be, the biggest theme in the whole movie. That's fantastic. I mean, obviously we knew female empowerment was one of the biggest topics that we were going to talk about when it came to this movie. But that's very powerful.
To a certain extent, it's almost the women in the film, I found, almost went through kind of their trial period to begin to – I'm not saying this right. Viola Davis's character went through kind of the hazing aspect from what's his name? Jamal's character? No, Jamal's character. I felt that every time he showed up, she grew up a little bit.
Brian Tyree Henry.
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah. It's interesting to see it sort of gradual progression, and you really see that in Alice as well. I appreciated her journey more. Sorry?
Oh, sorry for cutting you off.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just saying Alice was probably the most, shocking transformation, so to speak.
Yeah, hers is fascinating because she goes from isn't she dating the Punisher?
I don't know.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
It is, right?
The guy from Walking Dead, Punisher, he's been in a bunch of stuff.
But she goes from him to essentially prostitution relationship, escort relationship. And then from there, sort of gradually steps further up into herself. It's interesting. That's fascinating too, because what is the line he's? Oh, I got it here. She asks him, "Is everything just a transaction?" And he says, "It's the way the world works, as far as I'm concerned. Like everything is just about people are commodities. Everything is a commodity. You know, power. Get out of the way." I really found that journey really interesting myself. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. And there was a scene when she basically said, "Just because you're paying me doesn't mean I can't have my own life," sort of thing. And I think he said he was gonna, send a car for her, and she said, "It's okay, I can make my own way," type of thing. So, she definitely, even though she was she went straight from having her husband pass away to going into an escort relationship, but then throughout this whole experience, she was like, "No, like I'm a human being, so I can be an escort, but I can also be me and not just be your employee."
Yeah, it was that stepping out again, What did you guys think of the idea of truth in this film? It seemed that the film had a real balance between truth and lies. Did that connect with you at all? Was there anything you saw in that?
I think every character has their own story. Everything is different behind closed doors. In terms of, the biggest one would be Liam Neeson being a complete douchebag. living a total double life. There's also the aspect of Liam Neeson's, the other woman, I cannot remember her name. But when Viola Davis brings her to the restaurant to try to bring her into the group, because initially she was invited, but she never showed up. They meet later, and she's spouting off these lies about why she never showed up. Well, we find out later she didn't show up because she's living a secret double life with Viola Davis' husband, who's dead, who's not dead. But, you know, things like, I mean, the political backstory is one huge, everybody's lying about everything and everybody's trying to make everything look good. It's just the whole thing is very, lots of betrayal and backstabbing.
Mm-hmm.
And this race for alderman, I mean, come on. Whoever thought city council would be full of so much murder?
As for like Ward 17, too, it's not even. It's
and we thought the Toronto city council meetings were dirty. This ain't no Chicago.
Oh man, the Ford family would not survive. I'm telling you, I did
or
not.
Maybe they would just own the whole thing.
Too many jokes, Steve. I'm not gonna go there.
One of the things, again, I thought that was really interesting. It, you know, looking at the ideas of lies in this one, and it's always the men who seem to be buying their own press, if you will, or ignorant of their own of the reality of what they're doing. They just sort of cover themselves up publicly and they live lives the way they want. But again, it's the women. Like, one of the things I thought was it's sort of the women that have to take a good long look and face reality. Like, I think I think Jamal actually says to Viola Davis, I think he actually asks her, he said, did you know what your husband was up to, or did you choose not to know? Ooh. And each one of them, to some extent, sort of knew what it was, but they seem sort of like they don't want to stare it down. And the more they do that, the stronger they become. Truth was something that people didn't really seem that interested in.
I don't think anybody was really interested in truth in this movie. It was really just all financial gain, realistically. Jamal's character just wanted to get into power so that he could award different contracts and other monetary kickbacks to himself and live a better life. His brother was helping him get in power for those, presumably those same kickbacks, or he was just sadistic. Colin Farrell's character wanted to retain power so that he could retain the money that comes along with it and continue living his $50,000 painting lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
I love that. I love that. It's art.
It's art.
But even the females were in it for money, too. The same prospect, right? Like, they literally had everything snatched out from underneath them, so they're trying to get back to the lifestyle they're used to.
Yeah, they didn't want the money because they were greedy. They wanted the money because their lives depended on paying it back. So it's very, very different dynamic.
When I hear you say something like they wanted to get back to lives they were used to, I don't know if they were trying to get back to what they were used to. I think it was survival for them. You know, like Viola Davis didn't care about her condo so much anymore. I mean, I certainly Michelle Rodriguez just wanted her store back. But Elizabeth Debicki, like Alice, had nothing. Do we know anything about her before her relationship with, Frank Castle?
Other than she sold the motorcycle when she shouldn't have.
Right. Yeah.
Well, there's something interesting with her mother. You know, her mother seems very controlling and almost sort of tries to force her into a certain way of living. And that was another thing. She was sort of under the thumb of her mother and also her abusive husband. And so I think she was able to empower herself and sort of break herself free from both of those relationships.
Yeah, her mother is a really interesting character. Her mother is like basically whispering in her ear and dragging her down even further. It was really interesting. Basically, I think she's the one that shows her the escort service, isn't she?
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised.
I think she shows her the website. She pulls it up on the laptop.
Classy.
If you become a prostitute, you can go to college.
Oh my gosh.
That's what she says. Well, she didn't say if you're working at an escort as an escort, you can go to college. Going back to Truth and Lies, one of the things that really caught me. This is just obviously it's gonna be me like this is very much me saying this, I guess, but the way the church is used is fascinating to me in this movie, because the church keeps showing up in this movie and it's always bad. It always seems to be somebody using the church. Like when who was the guy that was the incumbent? Not the one that was – not Colin Farrell's character.
Not Colin Farrell's
character? No, the other guy.
Oh, Jamal.
Jamal, yeah. So Jamal is running his campaign out of a church, first of all, very clearly. And Colin Farrell even remarks on it. So it's sort of like – almost like this cover. You know, he's corrupt, but he's – in this church. And then who does he go to? Who do they go to fight about their endorsement? Is the church. They go to that mega pastor to see who can they get him to endorse. And even he's a little bit corrupt because he's saying, you know, well, yeah, okay, but depends how much, you know, who's going to benefit us the most. And they actually quote scripture a couple of times, but it's always the villains using it to justify themselves. I just thought it was a really fascinating sort of like defense, and it's sort of like a cover. I almost felt like they were using it in a way to sort of blanket, you know, just look at the outside and we're going to do whatever we want underneath. Because it just keeps coming up. I thought it was an interesting use.
I really liked Liam Neeson and Viola Davis together. And, I kind of want to dive in a little bit to their relationship and go back to those flashback scenes, because it's funny how from the beginning they paint this picture of the most loving and serene, calm, romantic relationship between these two people, and how devastating it must be for Viola Davis's character to lose her husband. And then we slowly find out that she has experienced this loss before with her son. And that was quite an interesting turn that I definitely did not expect. And so of course, then we find out that Liam Neeson is not the man that we thought he was. Mm. And neither was their relationship. I'm sure it struggled very much when they lost their son. But it's just very, very... very intriguing.
I mean, to a certain extent, they're the first scene where they're, you know, sucking face, for lack of a better term, was almost jarring to a certain extent, at least for me.
Do you think I wonder if that was planned from the director, or maybe I just find that Viola Davis does very raw and realistic scenes.
Hmm. It's not a loving kiss. It's almost like a... It's almost sloppy. I can't believe I'm talking about this way, but you're right. It's sort of a jarring moment to begin with. Both times I saw it, I remember the audience reacting sort of like, what? to that opening. I have to admit that as much as I appreciate where they were going with the son, the storyline of the loss of the son, I don't know what it added to the story that was necessary.
I agree.
That was the one thing I thought if it was trimmed. Now, I guess you could argue that maybe because of the loss of that, she chose to believe that everything was fine with Liam Neeson. Because I feel like all those flashbacks are basically almost like dream sequences. Like it's the best of Liam Neeson that she remembers. But she knew what he was doing.
I think if you were to switch the scenes around in order and maybe start with the scene with the son and the cop at the beginning of the movie, and then you slowly unveil that that's actually their son as the movie goes on, it may have been different. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept. I think that there was a scene when Viola Davis finds out that he was alive, and when they finally start talking in the garage warehouse, he says something along the lines of, I lost you two, and so now I'm trying to make it right sort of with my new family.
Yeah, he even goes, I think he even goes further than that. He says, I couldn't save us, so I had to save me.
There's a wow.
And he screams, yeah. He goes, me!
So it's almost like, you know, they lost their son, and obviously that takes such a toll on one and a relationship that maybe, you know, their relationship wasn't as strong anymore, and mm-hmm. they started falling away from each other. So he started looking elsewhere, ended up having a son, and he just wanted to rebuild.
Yeah, and even, you know, as we talk about this, even the color composition in the two scenes, this is what I did like about the opening, is it juxtaposes it really, really well. Mm. Because it's like this white, crystal clear, clean, you know, and then it was thrown up against this, you know, raw, gritty heist scene. You know, again, truth, reality.
Yeah.
And you know what, as I think about it too, I'm thinking about this now, I notice she wears a lot of white through most of the film and then gradually starts wearing darker colors.
Interesting. But get this one, and I wrote this down, and I didn't know if there was any symbolism to it, but since you said that, then I think this is exactly right. She's dressed all in black after the heist scene, and she's lying on the floor, and her gun is white.
Hmm.
So it's almost like, you know, she's dove into this criminal world, and she's in so deep, but she's still in there somewhere, and this is like her saving grace, and she's won. You know what I mean? She's not going to be beaten by the man.
Well, a gun is a girl's best friend,
And whoever has a white gun. So weird.
It's all about the style, Jules.
I know.
Well, this has been great, you guys. I really appreciate it that we could talk about this together, but we need to do Screen It or Skip It. Widows, Screen It or Skip It.
I would say stream it. While I appreciate seeing it in the theaters, I don't necessarily think it's worth the theater trip. It's a great story, but I'm on a weird journey when it comes to that stuff. I would rather watch a movie at home, unless it's a big blockbuster thing that I need to see in a theater, which I don't think this is.
Yeah, I'm going to say stream it as well. It's a good movie. It's worth seeing, but the action sequences weren't big screen necessary. So, yeah, watch it. But I wouldn't, if you don't want to rush out to the theater, then it's okay.
So we've established and answered our own question to start, is that it's you two that the reason that the movie's not making any money.
Yes.
Actually, no, I can't say that. You both seen it twice. So wait a second. Don't see it in the theater. Just wait for Netflix.
I'll take credit for not personally pouring in $45 million into the theaters for this movie.
Oh, I was just
saying that we're parents, so we don't get to go out. No, seriously, this is
it's true. It's true.
We don't get to go out to the theater as often as we used to. We used to go weekly.
Once a week?
Yeah. Yes, but so now we reserve our, you know, our actual theater going experiences for movies that are worthy to be on the big screen. You know, we saw Bohemian Rhapsody because we heard that the Live Aid scenes were, and even the sound, it was sort of meant to be seen in a theater. Things like that, you know, obviously Wonder Woman and all those big blockbusters. But something like this, you know, the action sequences weren't anything out of the ordinary. Do you know what I mean? So, and it's not all about the action sequences. It's not that type of movie at its core. So I think that it definitely could be watched at home.
I think it could be watched at home. I'm going to say screen it because I want more things like this. And
that's fair. It definitely needs to be encouraged.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you could watch it at home. And I think that, you know, the teens, as you say, are not going to be the ones that are going to be rolling out to the theaters. But if you're tired of the next superhero movie, this is a great pick. And I certainly feel no shame in saying screen it for that reason. I guess you're right. It could work on your TV. This is a type of movie that I want to see more of. And we won't. Well, that's not true. I can't say we won't, because Netflix, you know, will pay anything for anything. But I do want to see more types of movies like this, because it has a great script. The cast is on their game. It's tightly written and it's thrilling. And it has a really interesting soundtrack as well. We didn't even talk about the soundtrack. There's just not a whole lot of things in this movie that I didn't like. So,
Hans Zimmer behind that too.
Was Hans Zimmer the one that did the? I didn't know that he was behind it. Okay,
you're kidding.
Oh wow. Okay.
Do you want to know one of my favorite scenes? It was when she was in her apartment, and I think she was just looking out the window. And Wild is the Wind was playing. Wild is the Wind by Nina Simone. And that I love that song in general. I feel like if you don't know or have an appreciation for Nina Simone, you wouldn't really get it as much as I did. But it was just gorgeous. And that, I will say, is probably one of the scenes that goes against my stream it comment. Hearing Wild is the Wind in surround sound was just chilling, and I loved it.
Instead of using Spotify, you should see the movie because of Nina Simone.
Preach.
I'm going to put Nina Simone on this podcast in the background just for you.
Please.
Paul, Julie, thanks so much for coming on. This was a lot of fun. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us again.
Well, it was great having you, and as always, you can find the podcast on Spotify, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, pretty much anywhere where podcasts are available. And as well, if you go to the website, screenfish.net, you can go to the podcast page and download Fishing for More, which is some conversational questions that you have when you screen or stream the film, whatever it may be, with the people you watch it with. And we are in the middle of a bit of a blitz this month. All of a sudden, we're doing a whole ton of episodes. So we are going to have a new episode of the podcast every Sunday in December. We'll call it a Christmas bonus. But for guys, thank you again so much for being on. And for you at home, we started the conversation. This was Screenfish.